Tip Today with Fran Curry.
With Slattery's Garage, puck on. You can't beat experience. With over 50 years maintaining Peugeot cars and vans, we like to call ourselves the experts. Call Slattery's Garage for a free vehicle health check today. 067 24111 or slatterysgarage.ie.
Now it's time to talk global news. I'm glad to be joined in the studio by Thomas Conway as usual. Good morning to you, Thomas.
Good morning, Fran.
And good to see you today. Let us go to India and that extremely complex election that's happening there at the moment. Oh, over 6 weeks, isn't it?
Over six weeks. It's a gargantuan challenge. India now, just to give people an idea, 1.4 billion inhabitants. That's the current population. It is the world's largest country. It's going to eclipse China and become the world's largest economy soon enough. Of that 1.4 billion, 969 million can vote. So that's the electorate, roughly 1/8 of the global population, which is just staggering.
It makes it, I suppose,
a massive logistical operation more so than anything else, because you've to make sure votes are counted, make sure that people can access votes, get them registered on the electoral register. There are 543 MPs elected to the parliament, which is known as the Lok Sabha. And it's a singular parliament, as we kind of alluded to last week.
They don't have an upper house.
They don't have an upper house, yes. Yeah. So they, and the looks about obviously then goes on to elect the Prime Minister, which, you know, bar a major upset, is going to be Narendra Modi again. He's going to extend. He's been 10 years in power since 2014. Mm. His party, the BJP, has risen to prominence, and he has kind of consolidated his grip on power.
It's a coalition, though, is it?
It is sort of a fractured coalition, and the opposition parties who are challenging against him have kind of united together in a coalition. The main opposition party is known as the Congress Party, led by a man called Rahul Gandhi, and the name Gandhi in India carries extra panache. I think his father was a prime minister. I think his great grandfather was also a prime minister. So, you know, he has ancestors all around him who were in top office. Doesn't look like he'll get to fulfil that destiny. He's only 53, so yes, give him a couple of years, and maybe as he grows a little bit more into the role, Modi is 73 by contrast, so give him a couple of years and maybe he'll have more a shot of it.
And how does Modi fit on the left-right spectrum? Like?
So you could characterise him as centre-right. He's a Hindu nationalist is what he is. So he's gone in very strongly on these kind of Hindu ideals. He's been accused then of discrimination, Islamophobia, sure, for instance. He consecrated a mosque recently, a very controversial mosque in a city in northern India, which was the site of, I think, an Islamic temple. It was burned down in the 1990s by Hindu nationalists, and they built a mosque in its place, and it was kind of a symbolic gesture towards the Hindu community of his support for them. So he is very much a Hindu nationalist figure, quite divisive. Now, that's one way of looking at him. Another way is he has brought the Indian economy forward. It's turning into a really sophisticated economy, despite the internal poverty, and that is one thing. I haven't been to India. Anyone who I've said, you know, whom I have asked, maybe you've been there yourself.
No, I haven't.
Says the poverty is very visible on the streets.
Yes.
There are huge disparities in terms of income disparities and people living below
and
the poverty
is
threshold.
Is there a welfare scheme there, or do people just have to forage for themselves?
It seems to be a patchwork of different systems. I was kind of reading into it and reading into the policies that, you know, each of the campaigns have launched, and the opposition, Gandhi, obviously has gone in very strongly on inequality and advocated for a more just approach to that. Modi is, because I suppose he's centre-right, maybe state supports aren't as important to him. He goes for a more free enterprise approach. So let the jobs create themselves, in other words. But it would be very interesting. He enjoys he is very charismatic, and he has the common touch, and he's able to interact with voters.
And Thomas, that infamous caste system, is that still relevant?
Yeah, it is. And the tragic thing about Indian politics, because I get the sense from reading into it that Indian politics has really progressed. You know, they're progressive in some respects. They've introduced a measure that a certain amount of women will have to be elected to Parliament. I don't think it's enforced in this general election, but in the years to come, they're trying to up the female participation rate. So they are progressive in some respects, but that caste system is still in place. You have different ethnic groups represented in Parliament, and there is fierce discrimination across the board. Obviously, the majority of the population of India are Hindu and are Hindu nationalists, but there's discrimination against the Muslim population, but as well as that, other tribes and other ethnic groups in the country. So they do have problems. They do have internal problems that they have yet to solve, India. And despite all the promise, all the the favourable economic statistics, there are still serious shortcomings that the country has to address, I think.
I guess climate change must be.
Yeah, a prime example. And I mean, yeah. 1.4 billion people, obviously fossil fuel emissions are going to be a key factor there. And India is one of the main contributors. Now, some will argue, look, that's inevitable because the population is so large and because it's such a vast and sprawling country. It covers, I'm not sure what the land mass is, but, you know, it covers vast areas. It's huge. And obviously, climate change is going to be an increasingly important topic. Now, Modi hasn't shied away from that. He's not a climate change denier. Like, he's not... I wouldn't say he belongs to the hard right. It probably he's centre right, but it wouldn't be fair to characterise him as a far right politician. He's controversial and he's outspoken, and you know, he gets on well with Trump and he has other alliances like that geopolitically. But he's probably of the centre right vintage more so. So he can be reasonable in his approach to climate change, in his approach to certain issues like that. He's going to be prime minister, though. At the end of the day, that looks to be.
Who can vote there?
Any citizen above the age of 18 years of age. So that constitutes obviously 13.4 million Indian citizens who live abroad can also vote, but they must register and return to India to do so. So there is a large diaspora population there. That will have to return and make a return during the coming month.
So there's no postal...
Well, I think there are postal ballots within, internal to the country.
Right.
But there's no way of voting from outside, so you have to return. So that's a little bit, like, I mean, that contrasts to the way we would have it here in Ireland, whereby you're able to vote from abroad in one of the consulates or one of the embassies, etc. So that will obviously have an effect on the outcome. But as I said, the outcome looks very clear-cut. Modi will sweep the board here. He'll come back with a majority and he'll come back with a tighter grip on power. It'll just be interesting to see the trajectory of the next few years, because I'll get the impression that, you know, poverty isn't going to go away. He's introduced welfare schemes. I mean, free grain to 800 million of India's poorest, 1,250 rupees to women from low-income families. Measures like that, which probably aren't enough in themselves to generate much of a difference. And probably he needs a more head-on approach to really tackle
inequality.
Yes, but
with the huge numbers that the
makes it very, very difficult.
Must do indeed. Would you talk to me about Sudan? Because I think everything that's going on in Gaza and in Ukraine, it's sort of overshadowed. And you described it, the hell that's happening in Sudan.
The hell that is happening in Sudan and Khartoum, and largely under the radar, and obviously because we have been focused on Gaza and Ukraine, but Sudan in the past year has actually descended into a civil war, and it's a brutal civil war. It started about a year ago, a tussle between two rival generals, both military generals, both wanted to control the country. There was kind of a schism or a split between the two of them, and it resulted in one side, the military taking one side, and kind of an offshoot of the military, the Rapid Support Forces, taking them on at the far side. So it's a very complex picture. Even in the space of a year then, these groups have broken up into different militias and ethnic tribes, and it makes for a very fragmented political and military landscape in the country. Hugely dangerous. And of course, the impact of famine is now being seen in large parts of the country. There are reports from certain places where people are eating leaves to survive. Can you imagine that? Eating leaves. You know, it just outlines how...
Has the UN, described it as famine.
I don't think it has been completely classified as famine quite yet, but I mean, there is little doubt that famine is occurring in large parts of Sudan.
What are the outside influences here?
So there are weapons flowing across the border. Sudan borders the likes of Chad, Libya and the Central African Republic.
Right.
And there are inflows of weapons coming from those countries. We have to remember those countries have problems of their own, and they are struggling with internal insurgencies. In some cases, you've Wagner militia men. Remember the Wagner group,
yes,
whom we've
sure.
often spoken militia, about on yeah. the show? They are operating in places like that, and there are weapons transfers, so getting across the border easily. And that is probably contributing to the unrest, because weapons are being procured so easily and at such ease. It is actually contributing to the level of violence in the country.
And Thomas, is there any attempt at peace talks here? Or?
So the UN has a special envoy for the region. He's Michael Dunford, the head of the UN's World Food Programme in East Africa. But I mean, to quote him, when you look at the sheer size and scale, we're desperately concerned about where this is headed. On April 15, donors pledged around $2 billion to fund humanitarian efforts, but it may already be too late to avert the famine. So the famine is a looming prospect for many within the country, particularly in the Darfur region, which is to the west of Sudan, kind of bordering Chad. That is a region which is particularly hard hit.
But in the meantime, as you say, famine, and there's rape and abuse.
Yeah, and that is another thing that should be, you know, I hate speaking about it, but it's just the reality that, you know, women have been persecuted disproportionately, the victims of rape, right. of sexual abuse, and it just makes for a horrifying picture. And I think unless somebody gets a grip on the lawlessness, I mean, I'm thinking here there's going to have to be a UN intervention, a peacekeeping team sent in, because clearly in these situations, humanitarian funding is not enough on its own. I mean, money only goes so far, because where is the money spent and where is it allocated? You know, that is the crucial message here. So, I mean, I think there will have to be rapid outside intervention in order to improve the situation in the country. Your heart would go out to the people of Sudan. It's a country that had been, I should say, doing relatively okay in African terms. You know, a relatively stable democracy by African standards prior to the outbreak of this civil war.
But now
is
seen as a failed state.
Now is effectively descended into anarchy, you know, and is viewed widely as a failed state. So it's a real catastrophe there. It's a real worrying one for the international environment.
Is it interesting that we can all trundle on about our daily lives, and we can talk about Gaza, and we can talk about Ukraine, and we don't know that this is going on?
Yeah, it has really slipped
in
under the radar.
Time,
it's astonishing. And I suppose that is because there has been so much of a focus on Gaza and Ukraine that this has gone largely unnoticed. A couple of journalists have highlighted, Sally Hayden of the Irish Times is excellent. She wrote a book on kind of African politics and the migration struggles there. But it has flown under the radar. But hopefully, look, this will help to bring more attention to it. And people maybe can donate where they can.
And is migration playing into this as well? Because there's huge movements of
people. To a certain extent, there is, and there's an exodus of people from the country, which has to be acknowledged here as well. So there's a lot of people pouring out of the country. But it would be, you know, migration is a problem there as well. So, you know, a lot of migrants crossing the Mediterranean, some would be coming from Sudan, you know, so it's directly relevant to us here in Ireland, with immigration a huge hot topic at present, you know?
Right, and if people doubt that some of the IPAS people coming in here are coming from really unfortunate circumstances,
just read
about what's happening.
Yeah, and that is the thing. And I know, I acknowledge that the system is being gamed by some people. We know there is a degree of exploitation there, but you do have a lot of genuine cases that really are fleeing desperate conditions and desperate poverty.
All right. Our profile this week, our historic figure, certainly somebody who I would have looked up to over the years, Donal O'Malley.
Yeah, a fascinating figure. One of the great Fianna Fáil politicians of, I think, kind of a golden era for Fianna Fáil, of that Lamass era in the 1960s, who really came in and, to their credit, transformed the country from a kind of an agrarian society almost to a far more industrialised, economically more sophisticated Ireland, and transformed it. And I suppose his signature policy move was the free education in secondary schools. And, you know, I have to laugh each time I read it. The way in which he introduced, he was so clever. He introduced it to the media. He spoke to a pool of journalists.
Yes.
Kind of, it was the off season. It was the silly season. I think it was a Saturday. It was at the weekend. He announced it in front of a pool of journalists before he had actually briefed the cabinet. So,
and they couldn't go back on it.
And they couldn't go back on it because it was so popular. Jack Lynch was furious. He was Minister for Finance at the time. He said, where are we going to get the money to fund this? As it happened, it was a golden move, really, wasn't it?
Because it advanced
Irish education and probably in the long term contributed to the Celtic Tiger, contributed to the boom in the 1990s, the 2000s, because we had a more educated population, a far more sophisticated population. And we did have that, you know, free school system, which was available to many people.
So what about the man himself then and his background?
Yeah, a brilliant rugby player, which I only realised when I started reading up on him. He played rugby at provincial level for Munster, Leinster and Connacht, at club level for Bohemians and Shannon. His chances at an international career, it was kind of unfortunate. World War II broke out at the time, so his chances of an international career were kind of were put to the sword.
But he could have been a contender, he had the talent.
Yeah.
But Noel was associated him with GAA, for example.
It was actually soccer as well. He was president of the Football Association of Ireland at one point in his political career. So it wasn't just rugby that he excelled at. It was through rugby through which he met his wife, Hilda O'Malley, who had been engaged. He had been engaged to Audrey Harris, a sister of the famous actor Richard Harris.
She died
tragically at the age of 21. He would subsequently get married to Hilda O'Malley, who was from the Gaeltacht, Danganny Cush in Kerry, and she would assist him with the Irish language portion of his speeches. So they obviously collaborated. You know, you hear behind every great politician is a great spouse, or behind every great man is a great woman. And I think that was the case with Don O'Malley. I think it was very much a joint effort on behalf of him and his wife.
How did he end up in the fall, though? Because the family politics...
Yeah, the family politics, fascinatingly, were very much come on the nail.
Yeah.
But there seems to have been...
Pro-treaty after
the independence treaty. There seems to have been some kind of a split, some kind of bad blood that emerged between the two of them. And he quickly jumped onto the anti-treaty side, or jumped onto the Fianna Fáil boat. And he rose up through the ranks in Limerick Corporation. So he rose to become mayor of Limerick before his career as a TD. So he gained political experience. He was in college, went to UCG in Galway to become an engineer, which he qualified in, returned to Limerick to work, then entered the Limerick Corporation, became mayor of the city, and would ultimately then become a TD and a very illustrious cabinet minister.
But he was one of that new group of, they were bright. Were they known as what? The men in the mohair suits?
The men in the mohair suits, was the phrase used to describe him. And I suppose it captures they were kind of young, they were dynamic, and really kind of progressive and forward thinking.
Yeah.
And clearly...
Haughey, of course, would have been part of it.
Haughey would have been part of it, you know, and for all his controversy and that, they were very daring politicians, very charismatic and very brave. I mean, the education move was an incredibly brave move on the part of Donal O'Malley, because it could have went wrong so easily. And on behalf of that entire government, Lamass included.
The fact, of course, that he died so young then...
Yeah, it was a real tragedy because, I mean... Look, I mean, he went through his political career. He was Minister for Health as well, I should note.
Yes.
Obviously, Minister for Education. He held a number of roles, formal roles, but he died prematurely. He died at a young age. I'm not sure what age specifically.
I
had it here.
41
or something.
Yeah. Like that, wasn't it? Yeah.
So his career was very much cut short. Could he have risen to the very top position, you know, to the top of Fianna Fáil and became Taoiseach? Very possibly, in the fullness of time, you know, he was eventually, Lamass was succeeded by Jack Lynch eventually.
Yes.
But surely Donal O'Malley would have had a run for that position were he alive and fit and able and willing to do so.
I wonder what he'd make of where we are now. But anyway, just about a minute to go. So in terms of what we should look forward to over the next week or so, Spain, I suppose.
A big breaking story. Yeah. And I just read on BBC, news breaking within the last hour, it looks like Pedro Sanchez, the Prime Minister, isn't going to resign.
Oh.
That he's going to stay in place. So people who aren't familiar with this, Pedro Sanchez, the Spanish Prime Minister, announced last week, kind of out of the blue that he was contemplating resignation. Because,
well, this is because of his wife, isn't
it? He couldn't deal with the far right's kind of mudslinging and abuse of him and his wife. He's been the subject of trenchant criticism. He's socialist. He's a member of the left-wing Socialist Party. Prime Minister since 2018, so he's been a couple of years in the role. But clearly he had grown exasperated and fed up with the degree of criticism being levelled at him.
Even though a lot of people are saying that she did benefit from the fact that his political position.
Yeah, and there is questions around corruption there, and there is, and they probably have to be answered, you know. But it looks now, just judging by initial reports, that he isn't going to resign, that he's going to stay in place. He's going to announce it to the Spanish people in a piece or in a speech tonight. A man who might well be resigning, and I haven't mentioned it here, but it's happening currently, is Humza Yousaf, the First Minister of Scotland. So there's all kinds of ructions in Scottish politics going on at the moment. There's obviously disputes between the British.
Just before we go, I do want you to mention Macron's speech, because God almighty.
He really, he made a speech to the Sorbonne University last week, heralding or referencing what could be the death of Europe, essentially. Really ominous signals from the French president.
And what was behind that? The threat, the outside threat?
Basically, not just the threat from the likes of China and Russia, but competition from the likes of America. There is kind of a degree of economic warfare going on between Europe and America. All these kind of battles.
Protectionism
and subsidies and very complex kind of legal disputes. But
and
Macron,
then the possibility of Trump, of course, again.
The possibility of Trump. Yeah. And I mean, Macron's time is short. Like, 2024 or 2026 is his sell-by date. You know, he won't last beyond then, obviously. He served his two terms. So he's very determined to kind of forge a new reputation for Europe and make sure it is a lasting superpower, or regain that reputation as a superpower. So real ominous signals from him, indeed.
For sure, indeed. Thomas, always a pleasure. Thank you so
Thanks,
much
Frank.
For your time today. News and information is coming up.
Tip FM's Tip Today with Fran Curry.
In association with Slattery's of Pecan, Tipperary's main Peugeot dealer. Slattery's Garage Pecan, the name you can trust for over 50 years in the Premier County. Slattery'sGarage.ie.